We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another World Championship bonus edition of Perpetual Chess. I am recording this on Sunday, December 5th, and we have just completed 8 rounds. And boy, have things changed since the last bonus podcast. Magnus Carlsen has won 2 out of 3 games to take a commanding 5-3 lead in the match with 6 games to go. And we have 2 awesome interviews to share with you guys. Number one is with legendary 9-time Dutch champion and award-winning author, Grandmaster Jan Timman. Jan joined me from a phone interview from his home in the Netherlands in the middle of game 8. In fact, just after Jan Nepomniachtchi's fateful blunder on move 21 when he went b5. So at the time, Magnus taking a 2-game lead looked reasonably likely, but was far from guaranteed. But we wanted a more big picture view anyway from this legendary chess player and historian. And in our interview, GM Jan Timman contextualizes the match. He discusses the format and the debate about draws and all that stuff. And he shares some fascinating insights and inside info on the rise of Grandmaster Alireza Firouzja as we start to think about future world championships. For the second interview, we're joined by USCF master trainer and Twitch streamer John MacArthur. I recorded an interview with John on Monday, November 29th, so we do not talk about the current conditions of the match, but John had just gotten back from Dubai, which was his 6th world championship attended. He told some amazing stories from those accumulated experiences, and he gave great perspective on how Dubai compares to other venues and experiences. Before we get to the interviews, I'm going to do a very brief summary of each game, but the timestamps are in the show description, so if you're already caught up on the match and want to go straight to the interviews, you guys know how to do that. Well, if you're still here, let's get to it. So let's start with game 6. Wow, the longest chess game in history, in world championship history. As FM Mike Klein alluded to, it was a single game that almost felt like a series of novels. 136 moves, almost 8 hours. It started on a Friday at 4:30 Dubai time. It ended on a Saturday. Magnus in this game tried a creative opening gambit in another sort of Catalan hybrid type opening. Nepo again sidestepped it, perhaps wisely, and managed to steer it to basically an equal position. From there, things really picked up, though. The game had huge time pressure, massive swings in the evaluation of the position during that time pressure, and ultimately a vintage Magnus win. This game was more sport than art. Mistakes and brilliancies were both on full display. I hope and guess that you all had some time to watch some recaps of this game. It's an amazing slice of chess history that we got to witness. And you may even want to watch a replay or two of this game. It was just so thrilling and tense to watch it in real time. Magnus, of course, ultimately won and broke the deadlock. The one point I want to highlight about this match is that Jan Nepomniachtchi deliberately steered towards imbalance in this game. I don't know if it was due to inertia, or I know he said in the press conference he liked that he had the two bishops early in the middle game, and then ultimately, as Jan Timman mentions, decided to go to a queen against two rooks endgame. But all three results were very possible in this game, and it especially could very easily have been a draw at many points. So while the death of classical chess by draws narrative that we've referred to in previous wrap-ups, while that will be going back in its box for now, just keep in mind that draws are always possible in classical chess, and we, of course, could have had more of them. Instead, we got this thriller that culminated in just some amazing technique under pressure by Magnus Carlsen to take the lead after game six. Now, game seven was more like a consolidation game. Nepo again was white, and again he got a small advantage in an anti-martial Roy Lopez. In fact, the same exact variation as their prior game with Nepo playing black. But again, Magnus did what he needed to do in order to neutralize a small edge. There were a few moments where maybe Nepo could have pressed a bit more, but chess is hard and Magnus is a tough customer. So the pieces ended up coming flying off the board for a fairly quick draw, as I'm sure both players were still recovering from the 8-hour banger the day before. Now, game eight, which was earlier today, of course, again, the human element was on full display. Magnus, it was a Petrov, so Magnus switched to e4. He steered away from some somewhat promising dynamic possibilities around move 9 and move 10, especially the move c4 looked interesting. And he appeared okay with a draw as white. In fact, Magnus said in the post-game press conference that he discovered as he sat and thought for 40 minutes before picking his move that his brain was just foggy. So he ended up consciously choosing a line in 10 queen e1 check that he described as insipid. Nepo avoided the calmer waters, but also may have been suffering from fatigue as he made a significant blunder with 21 pawn to b5, which basically just blundered a pawn, therefore blundered the game and possibly gave away the match, although that remains to be seen. It has to be said that Nepo has been just pure class in every interview after every game, and he apologized for his performance in the press conference today. I personally don't think an apology was necessary, but you've got to feel for the guy. I mean, these games are so taxing. Game six in particular was taxing to even watch, and then to have to get back up and play the strongest player in the world in subsequent games, it's amazing to see the way that Nepo has comported himself. So now we stand with a 5-3 lead for Magnus. Ty Pruzimmerman of the Chess by the Numbers blog now has Magnus as a 99% favorite to retain his title, believe it or not. That doesn't account for any sort of increased probability of violence on the chessboard. Nepo, of course, will likely be throwing haymakers with both colors now. So I don't know if 99% is right or not, but I would dare to say that we probably have not seen our last decisive result in this game. And Ty highlighted the point that even if Nepo were to win the next game, his model would still have Magnus over 90% to retain his title. Again, these are just numbers when we have humans playing, as we have seen throughout this match. So certainly I'll be staying tuned and recommend that you all do as well. So on that note, let's get you all to these two fantastic interviews. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled Adult Improver Perpetual Chess on Tuesday, and then we'll be back with another bonus pod for the next rest day heading into Friday, December 10th. And while this match could possibly end before 14 games, it will definitely still be going heading into Friday. So thanks for listening, everyone, and please enjoy these interviews, starting out with Grandmaster Jan Timman after the break. Hello, everyone, and we are here with the legendary 9-time champion of the Netherlands, who, of course, played GM Anatoly Karpov for the FIDE World Championship in 1993. He's an award-winning author, most recently of The Unstoppable American, Bobby Fischer's Road to Reykjavik. He's a founding editor and a columnist at New in Chess magazine, and discussed his expectations for the match in the recent World Championship preview digital issue. And I thought it would be fun to get a sort of mid-match report. Now, we're recording in the middle of game eight at what may be a critical moment, as Jan Nepomniachtchi may have just blundered and Magnus has just played queen a3 check, which it looks like he's going up a pawn. But I want to focus more big picture on the match. But first, let's welcome our esteemed guest back to the show, Grandmaster Jan Timman. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's okay. It's also my pleasure. Yeah.
I'm delighted to speak with you. Always, as I've mentioned before, you're one of my favorite authors of all time, in addition to all of your achievements over the board. So I just want to hear your historical perspective. How has this match played out as compared to what you expected, Grandmaster Timman?
Well, I think that it's more or less what I expected. I think that Carlsen was a clear favorite before the match started, and I saw actually chances for Nepomniachtchi, and I still see some chances for him. But let's say in general, I think that overall Carlsen is a better all-round player than Nepomniachtchi.
Yeah, and of course, one of the narratives going into the match was about Nepomniachtchi's resilience or possible lack thereof, and as we record this, it seems like Magnus may be able to pull ahead if he can win another game. Was that a theme that you were alert for going into the match, Jan?
Well, I think actually the first game that Magnus won was actually quite typical, because in this game I think that Nepomniachtchi didn't show actually good understanding in general to go for this exchange of queen for two rooks, although it is still 0-0 according to the computer. In general, this is not a good idea. It's certainly not a good idea to play for a win in such a position. And although the game was actually quite complicated and Black had reasonable chances at some moment, I think he should have refrained from that, and he should have just made a very solid draw.
Yeah, it was quite surprising, introduced a large imbalance into the position, and of course changed chess history, because prior to that, the predominant narrative of the match had been the preponderance of draws and the seemingly potentially never-ending string of draws. And I want to return to that subject, but first let's discuss Game 6 a bit more, Jan. I'm assuming most listeners have at least reviewed the game and are aware of its contours. Jan, what was your approach to watching that game? Were you glued to your seat the whole time or checking in periodically?
Well, it lasted about 8 hours, so I don't think that I was there all the time, because I was doing some other things as well. Because, I of course, I follow the games, but meanwhile, I also work on a new book about the selected games of Max Euwe, my compatriot who was world champion in 1935. So I just alternate.
That's
and
excellent.
Of course, I followed the game and from time to time, and I saw that Magnus was actually making progress, and it looked very unpleasant for Black all the time, basically.
Yeah, a few moments where Jan could have turned the tables in time trouble, but mostly he was suffering. In those tense moments, were you watching the time trouble period of the match, Jan?
Yes, of course. Yeah, the time trouble period was a bit confusing, especially if you looked at the computer analysis. I mean, in former days, such a position, it would have gone unnoticed that that Carlsen, for example, missed a win when he could retreat his rook from c5 to c2.
Yeah.
That would have gone unnoticed in the past, but it's actually a very complicated variation that the computer pointed out.
Yeah, easy to see when the computer's screaming it, but yeah, not a very human move when you have seconds on the clock. And do you generally watch with commentary on if you're tuned in at a moment like that?
I watch at Chess Bomb, so you have some superficial computer analysis, but I don't look at commentaries, no.
Okay, so you just form your own impressions and seeing.
I don't want to hear a voice when I'm looking at chess. I just want to concentrate on the game. But sometimes I look at the tweets on Chess24.
Ah, okay. Yeah, and it makes sense. A player of your strength, you're of course able to follow what's going on your own. Now, how do you, when you see them manage their clocks like that and get in supreme time pressure in such a high stakes moment, does it recall any moments from your career, Jan?
Oh, sure, because actually now they have returned to this the playing schedule where you have increment before move 60, and I actually quite enthusiastic about that. Also, when I played Karpov in we played this match in Murmansk in 2016, we also had no increment before move 40, and that was my proposal. I think in general this time pressure is very exciting also for spectators. And I agree that increments should be there, but it shouldn't be too early.
Yeah, I find it quite entertaining as well. And of course, FIDE often comes under criticism, but I definitely commend them for that. I mean, it was just such a high stakes moment seeing them both with their time hanging in the balance. And Jan, I don't know, you mentioned you follow Chess24s. I'm sure you read some coverage as well as following their Twitter feed. What was your opinion generally about the sort of escalating complaints about the preponderance of draws prior to Game 6?
Well, I think that is something that has happened in many matches. So for example, if you look at the first match between Spassky and Petrosyan, also the first six games were drawn. That can just happen with some players of this level. And they were very well prepared. I think actually that Nepomniachtchi so far, he has only played Rui Lopez with white. I think that if he wants to, and I think he should have done this already before, he should vary, play some other lines. Try to find some new ways. It doesn't matter what, maybe to play Italian, the Joker piano or something like that, which is very popular nowadays, just to put pressure on Carlsen.
Yeah, well, with this ongoing game potentially leading to a two-game deficit, or at best a one-game deficit, we certainly might see some different opening choices in the second half. And what about with the black pieces? Do you foresee changes for Jan there?
Well, I think he has done very well with black. I don't think he could have done better. He was actually very hardly ever under pressure. I mean, also the game that he lost, he got a completely satisfactory position in the early middle game. He could have exchanged queens, for example. I don't know. I don't understand what his mindset was. Was he trying to win with black? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, he mentioned in the press conference that he felt with his two bishops that he might have a slight advantage.
Yes, well, maybe he had some slight advantage, but on the other hand, white is very solid, and later on, this weakening of his kingside actually became problematic. And to play for a win when you have a weakened kingside in general is a bit problematic.
Yeah, and we have a related question to the number of draws, which is from supporter of the podcast, Courtney Fry, who just asks, he says, in the coming age where computer engines reign supreme, where do you see the future of chess? In the next 30 years, do you think we'll start seeing mainstream changes to the way chess is played so that humans can compete against each other without being excessively influenced by deep computer lines, or where time controls change? What do you think, Jan?
I think it is difficult to say, and I don't think that we can improve that much. I think that all proposals, for example, the Fischer random chess, are not very satisfactory. And also Kramnik's idea to delete castling, I think that doesn't really make the game more interesting. I think that what we have now is the traditional chess, which has a very long tradition going back for many centuries. And I think we should keep it that way and hope for the best. That's basically what I think. But on the other hand, yes, what can you do about this computer analysis? I think that the players nowadays, they work really hard. And computers get better and better. And I think it's very interesting work. And I always hope that they play some sharp lines. There may also be draws there, but it becomes more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, FIDE did speed things up a tiny bit, and as you say, with no increment. So, yeah, I think as long as changes are made at the margin. Go ahead.
Yeah, that is a good improvement. I think you may even speed up the game a bit. Maybe just make it 40 moves in 1.5 hours.
Yeah, something like that. Because I know that traditionalists might complain, but the fact of the matter is, the more moves that are memorized, the fewer the players are playing on their own.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, yeah. Of course.
And Jan, do you have any other sort of broad perspectives about this match? Anything else that you found especially noteworthy?
Well, of course, the qualification of Nepo Amniachi is a bit surprising if you look at the world ranking list. But on the other hand, he did very convincingly in the candidates tournament in both halves. So he deserved to be the challenger at this particular moment. But I only gave him an outside chance. He should have leaned very heavily on the opening's preparation. Otherwise, I think in the long run, he will certainly lose to Carlsen.
Yeah, you highlighted nicely the quality of his play leading into this match. But the story may be getting rewritten. And returning to the topic of chess format, suggestion that I've heard with increasing frequency, it's perhaps becoming less relevant in this match, but the idea of playing the rapid tiebreak before the regular match, do you have an opinion on that potential tweak?
Yeah, I know. I've been thinking about that, and I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it's that satisfactory. It's a bit funny to do that. It's confusing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I guess that there is no perfect solution.
No, there's no perfect solution, that is for sure.
And we have Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think actually that Fischer's idea was not that bad, so that the challenger should win with 2 points difference, because and the draw's not counting. That is still actually a very interesting idea, but it's difficult to organize these days.
Yeah, it is. It feels like a blessing to even get these 14 games for sure. And speaking of Fischer, of course, your most recent book is highlighting Fischer's dominance. And we have one more listener question from Igor Feinstein, which is, in light of your recent book on Bobby Fischer, which he said he intends to buy and which I've been greatly enjoying, he says, how would you compare his style of play and will to win to that of Magnus Carlsen?
I think it's very similar. I wouldn't say actually that Carlsen is worse from this point of view. I think that in general, all world champions had something extra. Even some very quiet person like Smyslov, he had a very strong will to win. But I think for both Fischer, Kasparov, and Carlsen, this is exceptional, their push. Also, actually, Karpov must be mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that there's very little difference in the way Fischer won the title and Carlsen won it. They were both very motivated to be the strongest in the world.
Yeah, and it's good to see Carlsen defend his title a bit more than Fischer.
Yes, well, of course. Well, Karpov was basically just a very natural talent, and it was very hard to stop him in general. But he was a bit lazy compared to Kasparov.
Yeah, and it was interesting in your book to see you highlight your two heroes growing up were Bobby Fischer and Bob Dylan.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yes, I made this comparison that they both withdrew, actually, from the scene for 1.5 years, which is quite interesting here. I think they... Fischer probably admired Bob Dylan as well, and vice versa.
Yeah, Fischer, of course, an avid music fan.
Yes.
And as this match, as we record and win for White here in Game 8 is looking increasingly likely. So if we were to dare look ahead to another world championship, Jan, I, of course, have to ask what you think of Grandmaster Alireza Firouzja's recent play.
Well, I've been following him already for some years, and I think that he's really impressive. Well, the fact that he's only number two is just a clear sign that he will be up there. He will be a challenger one day. That is very hard to imagine it going differently. Of course, he has to prove himself in the candidates tournament, which is not easy, because there you play every day against a certain level of player that is not easy to beat. And nerves may become a factor. But on the other hand, I mean, his potential is incredible. And, I've been following him already for years, as I said, and I've seen him play in Hogeveen, in Holland, when he played a match. And he against Corey, and he was really impressive there. So I was just playing very close by him on the same stage.
So what impressed you?
At the time, I had contact with his father. We had breakfast from time to time together. Well, actually, Alireza was still sleeping, probably.
And did his father ask you for any sort of advice?
Yes. He asked me. He also asked me, but he didn't ask this directly. But he asked whether I was doing some training these days. And what would be a good trainer for his son. But at that time, I didn't think that I was the right person to do this, because it is far too much work. You need a younger person. I'm almost 70, and I think I cannot do that amount of work on openings. I could actually give players advices, of course, in a match. For example, if I would be an advisor of Nepomniachtchi, for example, I could give him some advices about openings choices, maybe about other things that are important, of course, but not really the real work. No, I couldn't do that.
That makes sense, and I'd like to return to that in a second. But first, what advice? Let's assume that Nepo falls behind two games here in game eight. What advice would you give him going forward?
Well, try some other opening for sure, yeah, with white. And I think in general, try to play sharp with black.
Yeah, it could be a very entertaining second half of the match if this result holds.
Yes, let's say if Carlsen plays e4, he could consider to play the Sicilian. That would be very interesting. Maybe just a knight of variation, something like that. With white, he could play anything. He could play, let's say, some c4 opening, maybe some flank game. That was actually the secret that Kasparov used in Seville in 87 against Karpov for the last game, for the final game that he won. He played a non-committal opening. And something like that, I think that could be advised to Nepomniachtchi if he's two down.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to come out swinging. And returning to the topic of your conversation with Grandmaster Alireza Firouzja's father, did you recommend any specific trainer for him in this conversation?
I couldn't. I said I would think about it, and I actually didn't come back to it. And I was thinking about it, but I couldn't think of anyone who would be suitable.
It's understandable.
It's not that easy.
Especially given his recent results, there's no one who can teach him anything, it would seem.
Yeah, I already had that feeling, that it was not easy to find someone who would be very useful for him. And he probably doesn't need it. On the other hand, if he reaches the candidates, I guess that he probably needs a good second, yeah, for sure.
And have you heard anything about, obviously he's had an incredible few months, have you heard anything about either people he may have been working with or what exactly he's been eating?
No. I was surprised that he is not going to play in Vacanze, but apparently they couldn't come to financial conditions.
Oh, interesting. I wondered about that. So it's good to know, because, you know, you'll see people complain online as if someone like Alireza wasn't invited. So sometimes you just can't come to terms.
Yes, they couldn't come to terms. Apparently, he asked a very good fee, and I'm in favor of that, of course. I think that young players should do that, especially if you're so successful. You must ask a very good fee, and if organizers don't want to pay it, okay, then you don't play. That's the consequence. I had this in the past as well.
Yeah, that's especially something interesting to watch as, because presumably Alireza has not concluded his ascent yet. So if he's going to be demanding conditions that are not often met, it'll be interesting to see that how that plays out in future potential matches and tournaments.
Yes, yes.
Well, Jan, I want to thank you so much. So you're currently working on a book about Max Oive?
Yes, and it will come out probably, I think, mid-2023.
Excellent. Well, we will look forward to that, and I cherish all of your books. Do you have anything to add, Jan, before we let you get back to your life of writing and occasionally checking in on these chess games?
Yes, I want to add that these games of Oive are really quite good. I'm commenting now on the game against Bogolyubov from 1921, and I just finished a game that he beat Maroxy, also a brilliant game. And and I'm doing this with a lot of joy. It's very joyful work to work on these games of Oive.
That's excellent. And I know that you did some engine checking in your recent book on Fischer. What's your general approach? Do you have the engine on the whole time, or do you compile your own notes and then go back and look? How do you handle that these days?
Well, the point is that you cannot always come up with all these lines that the computer finds. You have to make cuts, and you have to explain things. And it's not always easy. But I do my best. But the computer is very helpful if you want to comment on games.
And anything in all of the games you've recently looked at, both for Bobby Fischer and for Max Oive, were there any sort of shocking discoveries with the help of the computer?
Well, at the moment, no, I cannot think of anything, no. Well, there is one, I found something very interesting in Endgame that Oive beat Janowski in the first round of the Staunton tournament in 1946.
Okay, well, we will look forward to the details of that in your book in 2023. And Jan, just want to thank you again and look forward, as always, to your future books and your columns in New in Chess magazine.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Enjoy the match. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I am here with another old friend. He is straight off of the plane coming from Dubai, back in New York. He is a USCF master, a longtime scholastic coach in New York City, one of the originals, to my mind. He is a chess streamer. He streams under the name Master Chess Dojo, of course, not to be confused with Kostya Kavutsky, Jesse Cry, and David Pruse's Chess Dojo. He's coached many national champions, including Grandmaster Mark Arnold. And he just attended his 6th World Championship. He's also a registered FIDE trainer and been to 6 World Championships. He's been sharing his pictures of Dubai on his Facebook and other socials. And I've just, again, been watching and been jealous. So I wanted to get the rundown from this trip and also just sort of a broader comparison to the many other World Championships our guest has been privileged to attend. So let's welcome John MacArthur. John, what's going on?
Thank you, Ben. You're doing a terrific job with the podcast. I am such a fan.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And for listeners, John and I go way back. We often taught the same classes back in like 2001, 2002, which has been a theme with recent guests who are somehow all convening in Dubai, except for me. so while I sit here in New Jersey in my basement, but John, so tell us about the trip. Like, what's your greatest memory from it at this moment, you know, without having had full time to process it? But I saw a lot of pictures with legends. So what do you think most fondly of at this moment?
It was great to reconnect. I think there's no event like the World Chess Championship to really sew together the community of serious chess players. And the community really does bond around this event, because you're not there necessarily to play, such as on the first day when I was in the playing area and I realized I'm in this room watching the two players when I could easily be outside analyzing the game with my friends, as well as is often done. There are chess boards that are set up outside the hall. And occasionally there's some analysis boards near a cafe or anything like that where you can analyze with friends and people walk up. And there's no shortage of strong players available, not unlike Vishyanand being accessible. In 1990, I remember I had the board set up, and Boris Spassky walks up and shakes my hand. He's got a huge basketball player-like hand, and he has me by about 4 inches, and I'm 6'1". I don't remember how tall he is, but I know he was taller than me, or maybe that was just my impression, because when Spassky walks up to you at a world championship, you think, huh, right?
It's all figuratively, if not literally, but it sounds like both, yeah.
Right.
And was that at a world championship as well, John?
That was the 1990 Hotel Maclo. I think it was the 1990 New York Lyon match. For the last half of that, I had to fly to Oslo for an armed forces tournament. So again, each of the world championships, I only got to see a portion of it, with the exception of 1995. I was very lucky when PCA organizer Sophia Rode and John Donaldson, international master John Donaldson, and I head up the press room at the top of the World Trade Center.
So that's Kasparov Anand.
That was Kasparov Anand.
And the aforementioned 1990 was Kasparov Karpov?
Karpov, yes.
Wow.
And they had also analysis stations with many grandmasters in a variety of different rooms. In the World Trade Center, they had analysis stations in all four corners, as well as the central location with Grandmaster Maurice Ashley. And that was very eerie, of course, because we were at the top of the World Trade Center on the anniversary, I think, of the previous bombing in the garage. So they wanted an official event to reopen the World Trade Center after the tragedy of the attempted terrorist attack from, I don't even remember when the car garage bombing was. But it was quite an event. And I'm very thankful to the PCA and Intel for sponsoring that, and Sophia Rode for giving me that opportunity.
Amazing. So many world championship stories. And what about this one, John? So I got the impression online that FIDE's communication wasn't amazing about how to get tickets and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
So when
not have a ticket for the first game when I went in.
I was going to ask, yeah.
I don't know if you caught part of that or if anyone watched my stream, because I was actually streaming on my way to the first game. I had purchased a ticket and my credit card company told me I purchased a ticket. But because you try to make repeat purchases, like I'm going to buy a ticket for the first game, the second game, and the third game. Now, I'm making these on the Platinum app in another country. So my credit card company immediately flagged it as a fraud purchase right off the bat. So I couldn't purchase the second ticket. The first ticket never comes up. And I'm pretty certain that I purchased a ticket. But needless to say, I stream, and I actually conceded the 95 on my bill as I checked online, but I don't have the physical ticket in my thing. So I streamed up to the door. Then amazingly enough, they have this policy of taking away everyone's phones at the door. So I lose my streaming capability at that moment. And then I enter the facility anyway after they take my phone and whatnot. Fortunately, I was able to watch the first game, the one that I had already paid for. And I was in that room. I was afraid to leave because I was afraid I wouldn't be let back in to a certain extent.
Well, so you bought your ticket to Dubai not having tickets to the event. So this was in Dubai that you were attempting to buy the tickets?
No, I purchased them a couple weeks in advance.
But you were abroad?
I attempted a couple of them a week.
Or it was just because it was an international transaction?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So therefore, I never got around to purchasing tickets for the remaining two events. And of course, while you're there and you go online, the tickets are completely sold out. Now, there's massive amounts of room in there because I think they're only allowed to sell 50% of the seats available.
Okay.
Massive amounts of room available. There were a few other things I know they settled afterwards. Lennart Oates is, if I'm pronouncing it, fixing that as we speak. I got a chance to speak to him, as Sophia pointed out, that he was the person in charge, because I'm in the hall, I'm listening to the broadcast on the earpiece, only they're not showing Vishy's broadcast in the room. you just have the DGT board, the players, which is a lovely view. It's a beautiful setup. If anyone wants to see more of the setup of the behind-the-scenes Chess Base India, I had a good the Sagar Shah, who I had a great opportunity to meet, and his wife is lovely. They did a great job showing the premises. But basically, you're watching the players on one camera, the DGT board on the other camera, and in my ear, Vishy is saying, well, this move here, and he's so polite, if you'll allow me to make the move, then he makes the move on whatever board he's on, but you don't see it. And then we can put the rook over here, and this will allow knight to c3. Now you're trying to figure out what's going on.
It's good training.
Blindfold chess without notation.
Well, John, I drove home Sunday. I was driving from my in-laws from Pittsburgh to New Jersey, which is a 5-hour drive, and it was during the match. So I watched the first two games like in front of the screen, glued the whole time. But driving home, I just had an earpiece listening to the YouTube coverage without – I'm not going to put it on the screen. I'm not going to even glance at a board. I had the GPS on my phone. So I also got some blindfold training trying to follow game three. But it was tough because they're not saying the moves, you know. So anyway, but yeah, it's funny how that works. But you think FIDE will get these things straightened out in Dubai, the minor technical glitches?
Yeah, I think that they had the first three games as good training for the most part. Lennart was going to see that he could make certain that the broadcast was being shown in the room. But there was a little bit of a communications gap between what this facility was providing as far as coverage, or how many screens the facility was providing, versus what the marketing or the setup department was doing. And I have to say, Lennart is doing a great job, and he's hustling, and he's, I'm positive, being underpaid for this position because he doesn't have enough help. And crossing Lennart's, my fingers that everything's ironed out on the rest day.
Yeah, he's an amazing chess photographer, by the way, and listeners should definitely check out his website. He sells, you can either just download his pictures and then get them printed yourself or have them printed. I have a poster on the way, and if the online thing works, I'll probably be getting more. But so bringing it back to the match, I mean, one thing you say about them not being set up, I found it amazing. You know, David Lada, also from FIDE, you know, he's been tweeting a lot of pictures, and I've seen the tours that you mentioned, like I Am Tanya Sakchev's been sharing them online, and the aforementioned Sagar Shah of Chess Base India. So it looks like a beautiful facility. It looks very nice, but it was amazing. David's like showing them building the board like from scratch, like the day before the match. I'm like, you know,
I arrived early for the opening ceremony. In fact, I'd booked my ticket well in advance before the opening ceremony was closed to the public. So I had an extra day to go to the facility and see like wires hanging out of the press center. Right. It was like no setup practically whatsoever 2 days before the match. And I'm like, OMG, how are they going to do this? Yeah. And I thought the press room is inordinately small, which I think some people may have determined from Theo of Lee Chess, who quoted himself as having to work from a cafe 2 kilometers away, even though they're using the Lee Chess software.
Wow.
And I actually chimed in on that one, too, because Lukasz, I'm trying to remember his name. I think he is the FIDE. He might be the FIDE press or marketing director. Lukasz offered him the media center, which is still a little bit of a distance across the expo lot from where we are. But it was something because he threw in the free refreshments. I'm like, now that's a save. If you throw in free drinks and food, the nice. Trouble of being a little further away, that might be good.
And John, I saw you posted. You posted on one of your social media feeds a picture with Anand. Had you, in all your other world championships, come across Vishy prior to this encounter?
Well, actually, I knew Vishy from 1994 and 1995, also before the in the candidate cycle. In fact, there's a picture just above me of the 1994 candidates matches where I'm standing in the center. That one was sent to me by Larry Christensen because I was the PCA assistant arbiter to Carol Jarecki. And you have Vichy playing Romanishin, Tyviakov playing, Kramnik playing Kamsky, Nigel Short playing, Michael Adams is playing Tyviakov. Anyway, they're all in that poster, which was a classic for its day, and that was in Trump Tower in 1994. But prior to that, I'd met Vichy because Sophia Rode had organized the Winter Garden Chess Classic Festival, whatever, which is also up there in the corner, the Chess Days and Nights of New York, with the skyscrapers being brought up from chess pieces instead of skyscrapers in the Manhattan Island. But yeah, no, he hung out with us quite a bit. I was very lucky to meet Kramnik in those days because of Anna Hahn, also at that event. They were staying in the Trump Plaza, I believe, at the time, and they were like walk-in closets for rooms, and they were kind of disappointed that you're staying in the Trump Plaza. But for whatever budgeted room, it was just a walk-in closet. In any event, Vichy remembered me from those days, fortunately.
Of course he did. Vichy remembers everything.
If you can remember a game between Shirov and someone from an alternative move order from 2002 arriving in this position, which might have been in game three, I think, had that gone that way.
Amazing. And so did you... Yeah. And I'm sure that Magnus and Nepo are kept under, you know, they probably try to avoid the masses. But did you see them at all other than when they appeared on stage?
Yes, I was very lucky because the opening ceremony, David Latta had sent a letter out to the media or about the media not being allowed into the press conference because the royalty, the Emirate royalty of the UAE, I don't know whether it was the king or the son of the king who was going to be there. They decided to heighten the security. And it was held at the Paris Opera House, which is a certain distance away. I was very lucky that one of the members of my chat in my online stream for Master Chess Dojo, one of the members who lives in Jakarta, was there. And we met up on that opening ceremony afternoon as he was also inspecting the site. Completely unfinished and appalled that they are going to start in 2 days. But he was the one who sort of influenced me. Let's go over and see if we can crash the opening ceremony anyway. So we go over and we circle around, and the Emirate performers that are out front, there's like a troop of about eight that are dancing and playing drums and stuff like that. So as you approach the door of the opening ceremony, they start performing. But since we know we're not going on in, we veer off.
You were going to say you started pretending to drum and just like walked in with them. Oh, okay.
I didn't have the right dress.
The right attire, yeah.
Okay. I should not have a headdress or anything like that. So we veer off and then we start to come back. But every time we start to come back to approach the door, they start performing like motion activated performers. So we decided, we actually went around, we attempted to inquire about tickets, and then finally we actually went in past the performers.
How'd you get in?
A lovely young girl by the name of Sarah almost let us in. She was very earnest. She contacted David, but David didn't know Conte de Luna. So I didn't get a complete confirmation. She said she would have let me in had I, and she apologized because she sent the invitations. But while I'm talking to her, to bring this to a conclusion, Magnus and his father are walking out like an hour and a half ahead of schedule, because I've got the complete schedule. The opening ceremony was supposed to go until 10 and it's like 9:15. And so Conte de Luna and I decide to exit stage right and catch up with Magnus, Peter Heine Nielsen. I'm trying to remember who all was there besides those three. But of course, Heinrich is on crutches because of a recent accident with trying to do something on his own roof.
Oh, wow.
and he's doing pretty well. He explained to me, but since he was lagging behind, he was the one I engaged in conversation, and I wished him well, and he brought me up to speed on everything. I said, with all of the investments in companies and the promotion of chess, I told him, I think you can afford to have someone fix your roof for you. Right. And he said, unfortunately, I forget that I'm not as young as I used to be. Right. I can't just do these things. But so they went to the end of the lot and they were going to get into a car. I got a great chance to talk to Peter Heine-Nielsen about the first time that I noticed him. The first time I noticed Peter Heine-Nielsen, before he was ever even remotely close to being the superstar that he is now, he had played Joel Benjamin in the FIDE World Championship knockout in Vegas. And I was like, who is this guy that beats Joel Benjamin?
And that's 7 feet tall.
And he really did have me, more than Spassky had me. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah, and, he's not quite that tall.
He was very complimentary. He's told me, Joel Benjamin was an amazing player, and that he got very lucky, and that Joel had a winning move to avoid the tie, and he could tell that Joel realized when he didn't close it out that he the disappointment because Joel fully deserved to move on. He was very kind, and he almost gave me a complete recap of a game that happened in 1999.
Yeah, these grandmasters,
right? Yeah. And I was very happy that Joel got the thumbs up from Peter Heine-Nielsen, and he said, "Yeah, I wasn't anyone then. No one would have known that I was going to become trainer to Anand or let alone Carlsen."
Amazing stuff. So basically, it sounds like you have no regrets about taking this trip, John.
No, I think that I am hooked since the Kariak and Carlsen match that literally came to us in 2016.
Right, in New York City, of course.
I went out to Fulton Street and I bought the full match package. I only missed game one because of a prior commitment. Or actually, I apologize. No, game one was totally sold out, and you could not even get on the premises with that one. But with this tournament in Dubai, by the way, with this event in Dubai, most of the time you can go and visit and at least be able to analyze without necessarily having a ticket to actually see the players on occasion. So you should definitely make every effort to experience a world championship because FIDE is doing a great job. Emil Sutovsky is doing a great job. They're all trying their best.
Okay. Yeah. And so you mentioned these analysis stations. So could you explain a little bit more about how they work? So they're outside of the playing hall. You don't need a ticket to be in that part. And then are there like titled players analyzing the games, or is it just like kind of you can come up and set the position and talk with who's ever around who happens to be a titled player?
Well, there are six boards outside the playing hall, not to mention the large board that you saw David Latta photograph.
And to be outside outside the playing hall, no ticket necessary.
Not in this particular event, no.
Okay.
Occasionally there is, like 2016, and I'm trying to recall 2018, if I had to have a ticket. I don't think I needed a ticket to get in. You only needed a ticket to get to the playing area for the most part. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. I was lucky enough, with the exception of this one, to be invited to the VIP room of the 2016 and the 2018. And Nepo, who came out of the opening ceremony after Magnus Carlsen had gone in, I decided, I have pictures with Magnus Carlsen. Let me get a picture with Nepo. So I stroll over at the opening ceremony to get a picture with Nepo, and I remind him that the last time I saw him was in the VIP room of the 2016 event. Now, unfortunately for the average chess fans, the VIP room in previous years was the only place that you would see those grandmasters. This year, because of the sprawling nature of the Dubai center, you get to see them walking around a little bit more. Like you see Garry Kasparov walk through wearing black as he did, I think it was game two or was it game three? They're running together a little bit for me.
Yeah, I bet.
But yeah, he was walking with the Sheik, and he was not so approachable.
I saw him. I mean, you probably have too at some point, but just walking down the street in Manhattan, you know,
yes,
15 years ago,
Fairway,
right, exactly, and he's still not approachable.
I'm happy. Well, no, he's actually gotten a little friendlier. He actually nodded at me the last time that I saw him. And my other favorite one, after he'd retired, Grandmaster Mike Rode and I were at the Kasparov City Scholastics. He sponsors those in New York City. And he actually put his hand out to shake my hand when he was leaving. And I was so shocked that I didn't move. I was like, are you really doing this? Are you actually putting your hand out? So I shook his hand, and then he does the same thing to Mike Rode, and Mike Rode is completely caught off guard. He's like looking at the hand, like, "Who are you?" And and he was such a nice guy suddenly that he's retired, and I'm very happy that Kasparov, with his daughter and his wife settled in the west side of Manhattan, has found a little bit of peace and happiness, and he's turned into a nice guy and is retired.
Great.
He's got his intensity.
Yeah.
Still got his intensity. Like you said, it's not so easy to walk up to him, though.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, John, amazing stuff. These podcasts are going to be like people, I'm hoping people listen to them on the rest day. So we got to keep the interviews shorter than usual, but I think we got to do a longer one someday as well, John.
I appreciate that. I'll finish with Nepo setting me up on Kramnik, because, as I reminded him that I'd seen him in 2016, Potkin and Nepo are on this side of me. And he asks me, so what do you think of Karjakin? And I'm like, oh, he's a contender. And then I did not know that Karjakin was on the other side. And Karjakin pokes his head around and goes, what did you say? And I think Nepo did that to me on purpose. And I go, and I change my tone a little bit the next time. I go, you're still a contender. Oh, that's but it was amazing. A little practical joke on Nepo's part to ask me a loaded question.
Well, at least you didn't say anything bad, really.
No, I didn't really say anything bad.
You didn't take the bait.
That he was a contender. I may not have said it with the same enthusiasm the first time, but second time when I'm looking. But
excellent.
Needless to say, thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Thank you for the amazing stories. So the Twitch, if you want to hear more stories, Master Chess Dojo, I'll link to that. If people want to see your pictures, is your your Instagram and stuff public, John?
Yes, my Instagram and Twitter are both Master Chess Dojo. I am going to be, I know I posted everything to stories because that was the fastest way to get them up. And I will be redoing all of those photographs as posts as soon as I catch a little bit of sleep.
Get your bearings, yeah. Which, as we record this, probably won't be that soon, because I'm guessing you're waking up at 7:30 tomorrow morning to watch the chess.
Okay. Oh, no, I stream at 5:15 a.m.
Oh, wow.
Be Magnus Carlsen's birthday arena tomorrow morning.
Nice, excellent.
I know this is pre-recorded, but since it's Magnus Carlsen's birthday where he is already, we could all wish him a happy birthday, but obviously this podcast won't be released until the next rest day or so.
Yes, exactly, which is why we're not breaking down the games. But John, thanks again. Hope to see you in person soon.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Podcast Network.